homeschool youngsters. Is that right? Madison Homeschool, I'm sorry. It was the Boscobel High School. Would our students please stand? But thank you for coming. You may be seated. These young people are here with our Court with Class program, which is sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students are given materials about our class, about our case that they're about to hear. And this morning, or say this afternoon at about noon, these students met with Justice Wilcox, which is also part of the program, to meet with the justice to discuss the procedures of the court, not the substance. And they're here to listen to your arguments this afternoon. Not only have we won national awards for the Court with Class program, but I'm happy that to announce that the American Judicature Society has given a national award to an exhibit that we have that is now touring the state. The exhibit is about the 150th anniversary and the 150 years history of this court. It was under the sponsorship of a committee I appointed, the Historical Committee, and Justice Bradley was in charge of that exhibit. So we'll be very happy to soon, I hope, receive the AJS award for that exhibit. And these are just two examples of our public outreach program to educate the public about the court system and also to listen to the public about our legal system. So I've introduced the students to us. Now let me introduce the court to all of you. Starting on our far right is Justice Diane Sykes. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And to her left, Justice David Prosser. And on the far left, our newest Justice, Justice of Patience Rogensack. With those introductions made, we'll turn to our business at hand, which is the case 02-0980, Mark Anderson et al. Versus American Family Mutual Insurance Company. And arguing on behalf of Mary Ann, is it Brasser?
Brazier.
Brazier is attorney Mark A. Pennell. You have 25 minutes, counsel. You may proceed.
May it please the court, Chief Justice Abramson, members of this court. My secretary asked me this morning as I was leaving, how do you feel? And I told her, this is a throwback to the early days. Well, she's about half my age, young enough to be my daughter. And she said, what do you mean by that? And I told her that it feels really good to be scared again. Let me swing from one end of the emotional spectrum to the other. An incredible tragedy brings us before this court today. A young life was lost in an all too common situation. Perhaps factually this is a bit unusual, but alcohol is a scourge in the youth of this nation. And as the father of two teenage children myself, I am here to assure the parents of this young man that in litigating this case, I do that with a heavy heart and without intending any disrespect to his memory. When somebody in Green Bay hears that you're coming to the Supreme Court to argue a case, they are all full of advice. And one of the pieces of advice I received was, figure out why you're there. Try to determine why the court wants to hear from you. Try to determine why the court has agreed to accept your plea for justice in the first place. Well, in reviewing the cases and in striding up and down my driveway for about an hour yesterday, enjoying the beautiful day in Green Bay, I came to the conclusion that this court simply wants to answer a question that it had previously posed. That question was posed in footnote 11 of the Miller versus Tomac case. The question is quite simple. whether an underage person who consumes alcohol may be a third party so as to take advantage of the immunity exception set forth in 125.035.4b. That is clear to me, because I think that that is the more significant remaining question that emerges from the jurisprudence that has occasioned so far. And so in thinking about then what that then, I tried to figure out what my answer would be to that question. What unifying principle could I locate in reviewing the cases and in thinking about the philosophies and the policies that underlie those cases that would unify them, harmonize them, give us a basis to decide the case at bar, and provide clarity to an area of the law that candidly now needs it? And with all humility and respect to the court, I would submit that that harmonizing statement, that unifying concept, is as follows. A minor may not take advantage of the immunity exception if she or he is a party to the causal intoxication. They may not take advantage of the exception to immunity if they are a party to the causal intoxication.
Well, isn't that true? Then are they a party every time they drink?
Not unless their intoxication causes their injury. That's my statement.
So they drink voluntarily and they're injured. The other party retains immunity. Is that your proposition?
That's my proposition, so long as the intoxication of the injured person was causal. That's what this court was.
I agree with that.
That's what this court has been saying all along. In fact, the Meyer decision recites that in several places, at paragraph 17 and at 25.
So if they're drunk and they hit over the head by somebody else and there's nothing to do with intoxication, we don't have a problem.
Precisely. And that's the Miller case, Your Honor. The young lady in Miller recovered, notwithstanding the fact that she was drinking. That's true because her drinking was not causal to the accident. She was being chauffeured around by another young man. In addition, in Miller, that plaintiff did not contribute to the beer pot. That's critical. Because, Your Honor, I would submit that there are two classes of parties. First, the providers, and secondly, the underage drinkers.
Well, how would this fit into, let's say, the Sorensen case? This is the underage drinking situation. It seems, when I read the statute and then the exception, and I'm just going to read the language, of course, a person is immune from civil liability arising out of the act of procuring alcoholic beverages for selling, dispensing, or giving away. Then it says B. Sub 2 does not apply if the provider knew or should have known that the underage person was under the legal drinking age and if the alcoholic beverage provided to the underage person were a substantial factor in causing injury to a third party. So, we have the Sorensen case, which is the exception to which puts liability on the person who provides the alcohol. So would this be different than if the parent had some beer, well, let's say a quarter barrel or set up five bottles of vodka or whatever in a bunch of underage drinkers came over and consumed it, and then she doesn't pour the drinks. They just, like in this case, provided the alcohol, and then there's alcohol poisoning to one or more of the people. Would she be immune under that? And if so, why isn't this like Sorensen?
I would respectfully submit, Your Honor, that the Sorensen case, just like Pasquiat and some of the others, were decided before the advent of this statute. And I think that's critical to the analysis. The statute changes things, I'd submit.
You think that, as I read the sub 2 part, that would, under that, she'd be immune?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, what about the example that's given in the Lotto brief? If an underage person who has alcohol, this is on page 4 at the bottom.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Gives some vodka to a 6-year-old child from whom he's babysitting, and then the 6-year-old dies of acute alcohol intoxication, then the parents of that child would have no claim whatsoever against the provider. since the child consumed some of the alcohol?
Your Honor, I would submit that that circumstance is an extreme exaggeration of the factual basis that brings us here today.
Well, we could make it a 12-year-old.
All right. I agree that there is some point where the urge to party has to kick in. I agree with that. You can't simply put vodka into the bottle of a baby to quiet it down. You can't give vodka to somebody who, by virtue of his tender years, isn't in search of it.
Okay, so your unifying concept has some exceptions.
It may, Your Honor, it may. And I think that the consumption of alcohol has to be willful and accomplished in the context of teenage drinking. That is, of drinking for whatever pleasure is derived from it. I think that examples to the contrary, you know, liquor put into baby bottles and liquor given to 5-, 6-, 7-year-olds, I think that those are so atypical as to prove the point, Judge. When teenagers gather together to consume alcohol, the immunity should apply.
I have another question. Under 4B, 125.0354B, first of all, subsection 2 gives immunity arising out of the act of procuring or selling or dispensing or giving away alcohol to another person. That's the general rule is immunity.
Yes, sir.
Then 4B says immunity disappears, in effect, when the provider knew or should have known that the underage person was under the legal drinking age, and if the alcoholic beverages provided to the underage person were a substantial factor in causing the injury to a third party. I don't see how that section applies here because the youngsters here were not underage. They were under drinking age, but they were not underage, and it would seem as if for subsection 4B to apply, you have to have an underage person.
Well, clearly, both of the individuals in this case were beneath the age of 21.
Yeah, but they were adults.
I understand that, Your Honor.
So what does that mean in this subsection? The provider knew or should have known that the underage person.
I see what you're saying.
It's not an underage person that we're dealing with.
I think if we read the rest of that section 4B, Your Honor, it's clear that when they use the phrase underage person, they are describing anyone who's beneath the age of the drinking age.
Under subsection 20M?
Yeah, there and elsewhere, even under 4B1, the underage person falsely represented that he or she has attained the legal drinking age. I think there they
the legal definition of it. Why do you need it at all? If the person knew or should have known that the person was under the legal drinking age, it's redundant.
I agree. It could have been phrased better. I agree with that. But I think the emphasis of this statute is to control all illegal drinking, whether the person is a minor or an adult. I don't think that distinction is significant. It certainly isn't significant to the policeman who raids the party.
What's the legislative policy behind the statute, sub 2, in talking about that you are not immune if you, as the Chief read, knew or should have known that the underage person was under the legal drinking age? So the legislature seemingly meant that if you provide alcohol, the adult provides alcohol, he or she would be responsible for that act.
If and only if the intoxicated underage drinker goes out and causes damage to an innocent person, crosses the center line and hits a car full of folks on the way back from a visit to their grandmother's house. Innocent people who had nothing to do with the intoxication of these young people, either by giving them liquor or by consuming it themselves.
So the point is if you had the party in the basement, different than going up to the vacation home, and six people died of alcohol poisoning, as I stated, there would be immunity. I just can't... That would be a legislative intent. I thought the intent was to stop the person from providing the alcohol.
I think the Daring Court addressed this first, Judge, and this court subsumed that analysis in the Meyer case. There are two.
I sat on the Meyer case. applies.
There are at least two ways for the legislature to deal with this. Either, first, they could rely on the hammer of civil litigation to deter parents from providing liquor by holding them liable under circumstances such as this. Or else, secondly, they could deny recovery. They could refuse to allow young people to take advantage, to use this court's words, of the immunity exception in circumstances where the minor's own conduct proximately led to his injury, either by getting another young person drunk or by consuming the alcohol himself and injuring himself.
But you see, here it's the providing of the alcohol. It's the minor, unless they went in and someone sold to the minor, didn't procure, get, obtain the alcohol. The adult
exactly.
obtained the alcohol. And therefore, the reason for immunity would be that we want people to be responsible for their own actions.
I understand.
But here, the mother provided the alcohol and to Greg, her son.
I need to emphasize something that I had said earlier. The term third parties necessarily contemplates that there are two other classes of parties, firsts and seconds. The first category of parties are the providers. And there are a couple of cases that we can mention wherein providers were denied recovery on the basis that they participated in getting the minor drunk. The other category of folks who are parties under this doctrine that I've articulated are consumers. An example of a consumer case is Kwiatkowski. If you fall into either of these two categories or both, I would submit that you are a party to the consumption of alcohol, so long as it caused your injury. And under those circumstances, you don't qualify as a third party. My point is simply this. When we use the term third party, we have to think, third party to what? I don't think the term third party has anything to do with who actually pushes the money across the counter to buy the bottle of liquor or the quarter barrel. I think that the term third party contemplates that you are not a party to the intoxication that caused the injury in the first place. That is, you neither caused the person to be intoxicated, nor are you yourself the person who's intoxicated and thereafter caused your own injuries.
Counsel, I want to focus on this third party and also on your proffered unifying theme.
Yes, Your Honor.
It is a minor may not take advantage. I assume, based on the exchange with the Chief Justice, that you would modify that to underage person.
You're right, Your Honor. Yes,
okay.
Ma'am.
An underage person may not take advantage of immunity if he or she is a party to the causal intoxication. Now, your proffered interpretation seems to read out what's set forth in sub B and to read in part of what sets forth in sub B. And let me make specific my inquiry. Your proffered interpretation seems to read out a third party. You say if he or she is a party. Does it make any difference? First, second, or third? I mean, I may be first, but it doesn't make any difference. Second or third in your offering. Is that correct?
Let me explain, Your Honor. If I were to change my verbiage to say that the exception cannot be invoked by one who is either a first party or a second party to the intoxication. And by first party, I'm describing people who supply the liquor, and by second party, I mean people who consume it.
That gets me to what I think you may have added. And I'm not saying you're adding this erroneously. I'm just saying it's not in the statute. You're adding it.
Yes,
and
Your
that
Honor.
Is a fact. I'm looking at the statute and the phrase, were a substantial factor in causing injury to a third party. The statute doesn't indicate anything about a third party who did not consume the alcohol or who did not procure the alcohol or who did not, dispense the alcohol. You're reading that in to modify the third party where that isn't verbatim in the statute. Is that correct?
That's right, Your Honor. I taken a look at the cases that have interpreted it and tried to distill them into an operational definition of what we mean when we say third party. And that's the conclusion at which I arrived, and I think there is some logic to it, if I may humbly submit. I think that the legislature, in enacting this law, basically said a pox on both your houses. If you are involved in any way in teenage drinking and you hurt yourself, that is either because you caused another to be intoxicated or because you yourself became intoxicated, as a matter of public policy, we will not accord you the benefit of this immunity exception. We are reserving that for people who truly come with clean hands, with pure innocence, to a tragic situation by virtue of underage drinking.
Mr. Pinnell, what's wrong with my plain meaning approach, or call it simple-minded approach, to this exception? I look at this statute, I look at the exception to the statute, and it strikes me that the provider is Mary Ann, the underage person is Greg, the third party is Craig Anderson, and what occurred here is clearly a substantial factor in regard to injury. That seems to coincide with what I see as the plain meaning of the statute. What's wrong with that?
I believe that the deceased, Your Honor, is actually a second party. He is an underage drinker who consumed alcohol. He didn't get it directly from her, but when you think pragmatically, Your Honor, when you think about how these parties work, do all the kids file into the grocery store to buy the case of beer? No. In fact, I'm thinking on the way up about all the occasions, the law was different in my time, but when I was 19 or 20 years old, where we would send someone to buy the quarter barrel. That would happen typically over the lunch hour, and that person would take that beer. And then later on that night, after we all got off work at our various summer jobs, we would meet somewhere, hopefully safely, hopefully in a circumstance that wasn't completely counterproductive, and we would drink that beer. Under that scenario, Your Honor, the only person who couldn't sue the owner of the store is the fellow who actually went in and purchased the beer with some money that he'd taken from his mom's purse. Everybody else at the party who consumed the beer, as one would normally expect them to do, would still have a cause of action because they would be third persons. They would be people who got the beer not directly from the store in driving up and picking up the barrel, but rather through their friend who had the money and the time to go buy it.
Well, is there anything in this record that shows that, for instance, the provider, Mary Ann, knew that Craig Anderson was going to be partaking of this vodka along with her son, Greg?
No, Your Honor, that's not explicit. She knew that the boys, that a small group of boys were going to be there, but the record doesn't say anything whether she did or did not know that her son was going to consume 42-ounce bottle of liquor over the span of 2 days. I think that the implication is that she was not giving her son a single can of beer. She was providing alcohol to him in a large, large quantity. And if we are to draw any inference from the facts before us now, that inference can only be that the possibility of more than one person drinking from that bottle arises.
Well, I was interested. Now, she, as I recall, she bought the vodka. It was 1.7 liters, which is obviously, as you say, 42 ounces. And she left a note. Greg, you owe me $12.
Yes.
So that's what... So there isn't anything in the record, at least that I could find, that would... So you're just saying that's an assumption that he would not drink it himself.
I think it's a reasonable inference to be drawn from the facts, Your Honor.
So if she... So we have to look at the volume of alcohol purchased to... depends on whether it was... You know, if it was a small bottle, then the assumption would be that was for his own... self-consumption. Here it seemed to me that she was bought the liquor because he was underage and he owed her $12.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I realize that it's not perfectly clear as to how much liquor constitutes enough for more than one. I don't pretend to try to answer that today. All I know is that in this instance, under these facts, we know that a lot of liquor was provided. And under these facts, this woman could be we could easily infer and probably would infer as parents that this bottle was to be consumed or could possibly be consumed by more than just her son.
Now, but going back to Justice Crooks's question, when you have Mary Ann being the provider and it's supplied to Greg, it seems to me when you look at the parties, first party, second party, But you've got, so you've got, you never get beyond second party. Everybody else is second party.
I think that's right, Your Honor. If we reach another conclusion, think what we're telling kids. Make sure you're the one to go to the liquor store to buy, or make sure you're not the one to go to the liquor store to buy, because if you do buy it, then you can't sue him if you get in an accident. But if you're not the one actually to push the money across the counter, and if you didn't chip anything in to help buy, then you're scot-free.
What are we telling adults, then? I mean, we're telling adults if you buy the alcohol and you provide it to the to somebody, then you won't be held liable either.
That is the
effect. That doesn't seem to be the message that 125 points out. That's what I was talking about, the legislative intent.
I agree, Your Honor. And as I think this Court pointed out in the footnote to Daring, there are two approaches the legislature could have taken in trying to deal with this social problem. One is to allow the hammer to come down on parents. The other is to deny recovery to the injured children. And they've chosen the second route. Whether it's wise or unwise, that's the route they've decided to take.
I'm not sure that I agree that the intent in sub B is to deter consuming children. I think an argument can be advanced that sub B, I'm talking about 4B, 125.035.4B, is to deter providers rather than children who may consume. And part of that belief on my part is based on this. I don't think whether or not a 17-year-old is going to come up in a lawsuit against the bar of immunity has anything remotely to do with deterrence. I just think that that is so far from any 17 or 18 or 19 or 20-year-old's mind when they're in the gravel pit on Friday night at 10 o'clock consuming alcohol. And so that anyone, so I don't think it is sound basis to suggest that this apply, that you have to read in a third party who consumes alcohol because the legislature intended to deter kids consuming alcohol. I think that sub B is meant to deter the provider. How do you respond to that?
Judge, I'm looking now at the Daring decision where in the court talks about how to allocate the responsibility for negligently supplying alcoholic beverages. And you're right, Your Honor. Part of it is that they concluded how to allocate from a financial point of view the risk of loss. And one of the considerations, in all honesty with the court, is that there was the concern for the providers, for the commercial providers of alcohol, that they not be saddled with this. But on the other hand, Your Honor, I think it's abundantly true that the statute has been interpreted in this context and that the possibility of using the common law to deter this kind of conduct by allowing suits has been rejected by this Court, first in Daring and then later in Meyer versus Champs.
But wouldn't, to follow up on Justice Wilcox's question, wouldn't your interpretation by adding the qualifying language to a third party who consumes alcohol seem to be counter to the goal of deterring providers?
Two responses, Your Honor. First off, if civil litigation or if a claim were to arise successfully from this circumstance, you're right. I mean, as a litigator, I feel very strongly that the common law could deal effectively with these circumstances and represent a deterrence. But secondly, I think in the Daring case, they also observe, Your Honor, that there are significant criminal penalties for this kind of conduct, criminal penalties that to this day prevent my client from giving a deposition for fear of impairing her Fifth Amendment rights. And I think that that's part of the balancing test as well. The legislature determined that we've already got a plenty big hammer to use on people to supply alcohol, whether they're stores or whether they're parents or anything else, and that is it's very illegal. a fact that has been noted by both sides in this case. And so I think the conclusion is simply this, that we don't need the additional deterrence of civil liability on top of criminal penalties that have significant financial as well as personal freedom implications to deter parents, store owners, and so forth from participating in the sale of alcohol to underage drinkers.
Can I ask, sir, if your client is found not to be immune, what is the next step? That doesn't translate to automatic liability, does it, or does it?
I don't believe so, no, Your Honor. All it does is it gets the claim past the threshold. Then I think there is we try the case right from the beginning. We look at contributory negligence, for example. That we argue to the court that his own negligence was as a matter of law, more substantial than anyone else's when he voluntarily picked up the glass and drank from it. And all of those issues come into play. I agree with that, Your Honor. Right now, we're simply at the threshold stage. Is the claim barred in its entirety by virtue of his underage drinking?
Your position is it is.
It is. That's right, because he's one of the second parties. To rule otherwise subjects us to a microanalysis of every case that comes before us and a trip at least to Wausau, if not down to Madison, in each instance.
And the microanalysis is what? Whether the person who was injured, the consumer of alcohol was injured, was the person to whom the alcohol was provided?
Right. How close do we have to be? Is waiting in the car enough to make you a second party instead of a third party? The separation in time sufficient? If we buy the quarter barrel at noon but we don't drink it until 8 o'clock at night, is that a sufficient time passed by such that the drinkers who didn't go to the store to buy it and didn't pay for it somehow become third parties rather than second parties? The slope becomes extraordinarily slippery. I advance my analysis because I think it was contemplated by the legislature and because it harmonizes the previous cases, it disposes of the case at bar, and most importantly, it helps shape our jurisprudence in this difficult area of the law.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Kowalkowski.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Attorney Frank Kowalkowski of Hanaway & Ross appears on behalf of Mark and Janet Anderson, the plaintiffs, appellants, respondents. Although I'm not sure I agree with Mr. Pinal's sentiments that it feels good to be scared again, I do agree with the scared part. One thing Mr. Pinal indicated is that his theme, the harmonizing aspect of all of this, would tie everything together. And even if that argument has some merit, I can't help but go back to the statute itself. And to get that harmonizing effect, you would have to add language to 125.035. There is nothing in that statute that says you're a third party only if you didn't consume some alcohol. You're a third party only if your injuries were caused from an auto accident rather than consumption. Those qualifiers just don't exist in that statute. And it's that reason why I believe the statute as written allows the Andersons to pursue their claim.
But do you agree that, and I suppose this is your position, that under 4A, Ms. Brazier is a provider?
I believe she is a provider, correct.
And so then your position is she was a provider because she procured alcohol or gave away or sold alcohol to an underage person. The underage person is her son.
Her son, Greg Brazier.
Okay. So she falls under 4A. So then we get to 4B. Immunity doesn't apply if the provider, and we've already said she's a provider, knew or should have known that the underage person was under the legal drinking age. Well, she should have known here because it was her own son.
Correct.
Right? And if the alcohol beverages provided to the underage person, her own son, were a substantial factor in causing injury to a third party, and I guess everybody agrees there would be alcohol was a substantial factor in causing injury to Greg.
Yes.
So what we're worried about here is he a third party, right?
I believe that is the issue before the court.
And we're worried, too, here as to what does underage person mean? Let's say that it's defined under 20M, and we'll forget about the redundancy in 4A. And so is it Craig that's the underage person? Is it Craig and others whom she might have foreseen or should have foreseen would drink it?
Well, they're both underage from the aspect of they didn't attain the legal drinking
right.
age.
And we agree on that.
The underage person to whom she was a provider was her son, Greg. Because there is no evidence that Craig Anderson knew that transaction was going to happen, contributed money, was anywhere present, in the house or in the neighborhood at the time that transaction occurred.
Suppose she knew that he was going to have a little party and there would be underage children. Would that make her a provider to all of the drinkers there?
I don't believe it would. That was something I believe Mr. Pinal wanted the court to imply because of the volume of the liquor which was provided. But I don't think you can make that leap. I mean, that's simply not the facts of the case. And even if the fact was Greg told her, hey, Mom, I need a lot of vodka because I'm going to have some friends over, I still think, as to those friends who did not know Greg was asking that question, who did not know where Greg was going to get the alcohol, who in no way contributed to the money, they're still third parties.
As I understand this, counsel, the way your opponent is arguing is that Craig consumed the alcohol, therefore he's responsible for that, and the legislature did not want to cover that. What if, I'm just thinking, and it only applies to third parties, so Craig could have drank some alcohol, gotten in a vehicle, and had a one-car accident, only hurting himself, not others. And if I understand your opponent's argument, opposing counsel, that still would not infer liability because he caused the accident and he drank. He drank and caused his own accident. So it's only when he hurts a third party is when liability would come in. That's the way that I think he wants us to interpret this.
That very well may be. I guess my point is that Mary Ann provided the alcohol to her son, Greg, and it caused an injury to Craig, whether it was because of his consumption and alcohol poisoning, because he got in a car with someone else and got in an accident, or because he got behind his own car and got in an accident, doesn't change the fact that he's a third party as to the transaction between Mary Ann and Greg.
Yeah, it was provided to him. That's what you're arguing. Got it. She provided the alcohol to Greg, and then Craig got it from there.
In a separate transaction.
That's right.
This case, I think, can boil down to, or at least one way of approaching it can boil down to, whether or not this is two transactions or three, whether there's two parties or three parties, whether it's one transaction or two transactions. And I want to focus on that and whether or not such a determination is appropriate for summary judgment on this record. Did the mother, Mary Ann, provide alcohol to Craig? It's your position she did not. Let's say, and I want to touch on the slippery slope mentioned by your opposing counsel. Let's say Craig was in the living room when Greg was in the kitchen and asked his mom. How does that change whether or not she, the mother, provided alcohol to Craig?
I think under the Court of Appeals decision in Miller that it doesn't change my position. In Miller, for example, there was evidence that the plaintiff, Ms. Miller, actually solicited Brian Cleary, the 21-year-old, to get the alcohol. And in that case, she didn't contribute money. She wasn't one of the people who contributed to the fund.
You've changed, though, interestingly. See, I think what's unclear is from whose perspective from the injured party's perspective or from the provider's perspective. If the mother here, Mary Ann, knows Craig, sees Craig, and Craig is standing right next to her son, Greg, does the record reflect, in that kind of a hypothetical, would the record reflect that Mary Ann intended to provide Craig alcohol?
I believe it would be a matter of degree. I think the question is to paraphrase, if I'm correct, is Craig Anderson also the underage person to whom Mary Ann provided alcohol under your hypothetical?
Mm-hmm.
He's standing in the next room. Mm-hmm. And I think if it was a joint venture by Greg and Craig to both go to Mary Ann and solicit this alcohol, that in under that scenario, that's a possibility.
Okay, so your response is that the injured party, it is from the injured party's perspective whether or not the injured party is trying to procure alcohol, as opposed to the statute should be interpreted from the provider's perspective of what the provider intends. From whose perspective should this be viewed?
I guess I view it as looking at the totality of the facts, and I don't necessarily isolate it that it's from one perspective or from the other. I think under your hypothetical, both if Mary Ann provided only to her son, I mean, from that perspective, he's obviously a third party, but the same holds true if you're standing in Craig's shoes and he had nothing to do with that transaction.
Well, let me be more crisp in this then. The two boys are standing together. Greg says, "Mom, I want some vodka. A bunch of us are going up to the cottage for the weekend." Is Mary, and Mary Ann gets it, is Mary Ann providing, and they're standing right together, vodka for Craig?
I think under that scenario, an argument could be made that she provided to both Greg and Craig. Craig was not disassociated from the transaction as he was in this case, which is, I think, something that was pointed out in the Meyer court, where they would not allow the plaintiff to go after Mr. Augustine, saying, you know, under no time during that evening did he disassociate himself from the whole buying, selling, giving to my friend.
So where do you draw that line? You've said now, okay, and when they're next to each other.
I think,
not maybe when they're in the next room?
I think in your hypothetical, Mary Ann knew she was giving the alcohol to Craig because he's standing right next to Greg when she does it.
Mm-hmm.
Craig knows Mary Ann's a provider because she's right there when it gets handed over to one or both
of
them.
No, she comes back later under the facts of this case, and I'm assuming that. No, she goes and gets it at the grocery store and leaves a note for Greg saying, "You owe me 12.
Under the facts of this case. But the way I understood your hypothetical, all three people knew Mary Ann was providing to these two underage. They all were on the same mindset. Mary Ann's giving it to both. They both are soliciting it.
Both were
Mary
there
Ann.
When it was requested, but not when it was delivered. Does that make a difference?
If, I believe under those scenarios, if the third party was in no way present, and I think you have to get into whether or not he somehow made it occur. And if it was he in no way, shape, or form made it occur, he might have been present when Greg asked his mother, but he didn't induce it to happen. I think he still is a third party.
Well, what do you think? Go ahead, just.
Justice Prosser?
In trying to determine what a third party is, are there any conditions that are essential to be a third party? Let me put it this way. You have Mrs. Brazier, and you have Greg, and you have Craig, and Craig is a minor. Does it make any difference if Craig were 21?
I don't believe that would necessarily impact his third party status. I don't believe age is a determining factor in qualifying someone as a third party under the statute.
Well, suppose the plaintiffs here are the parents of Craig. Are they third parties? Or if there were children of Craig, would they be third parties?
To the extent they were injured by the result of their death, I suppose, yes. I mean, they did suffer damages as a result of Mary Ann's provision of alcohol to Greg.
Well, Counselor, under your scenario, then, if Mary Ann sold it to Greg, who is under the legal drinking age, and Greg provided it to Craig, who was 21, and Craig had the same unfortunate outcome, that he would still be able to take advantage of the exception to immunity, correct?
Yes.
Thank you.
The whole point of the statute, talking about legislative intent, seems to be aimed toward adults that provide alcohol to underage people that are under the legal age of drinking. That seems to be the intent. Is that your understanding?
I would agree with that. In fact, in Miller, the court stated the interpretation is consistent with Wisconsin public policy expressed in the statute and judicial decisions. The nature and extent of the problem of underage drinking suggests the legislator intended to broadly prescribe acts which lead to underage drinking, which to me goes more to the person providing it as opposed to the underage person receiving it.
And Miller came after the statute.
Yes, it did.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. Miller was after the statute.
And Miller even goes on to state that they're trying to place culpability on the person who should have known the person was underage. Again, it's pointing the finger at the provider.
What about the argument that under your position, we're really encouraging rather than discouraging the underage drinker, that there's no penalty for the underage drinker, other than perhaps a civil penalty of some sort, but no penalty under this statute?
Well, there is if you're the underage drinker to whom the alcohol was directly provided. So at least under that setting, there would be some discouragement. As far as if you're a third party, I would agree that the statute doesn't deter third parties who are injured just because they may have consumed. I don't think the statute reaches that far. It does, though, deter it to the original underage person who asks for it and gets it directly from the prospective plaintiff.
Do you think it's far-fetched to conclude that the legislature wanted to discourage not only the provider or procurer, but also underage drinkers?
Well, I think the legislature in this and several statutes try to discourage underage drinking regardless of which perspective you're coming from. For example, there is a statute against the provision of alcohol to a minor, which is the reason Mary Ann has pled her Fifth Amendment rights to be deposed. There's a statute that could result in a citation for an underage minor for the underage consumption. So I think the legislature has come from both directions in trying to discourage it. However, I believe this particular statute, 4 sub B, which lifts that immunity, is targeted more toward the provider as spelled out in the Miller case.
Counsel, why isn't Greg the provider of Craig rather than Mary Ann?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
Why isn't Greg the provider of Craig with the alcohol rather than Mary Ann being the provider?
I believe arguably Greg is a provider to Craig.
Mm-hmm.
And the cause of action against Greg is not before this court. It was determined that from that perspective, the transaction between Greg and Craig was not a third party. So I would agree that could be an interpretation.
Okay, so let me add something in a hypothetical. Say Mary Ann gave the alcohol to her son, who was under 21 years of age. He gave it to a friend of his who wanted to have a party. The friend was 21, and that friend then provided it to someone who had the same result that Craig had here. Does that break the chain from Mary Ann, or is Mary Ann still a provider under this scenario?
I believe it would not necessarily break the chain because it all stems from the illegal provision of alcohol by Mary Ann to a minor.
So under your scenario, any time you give alcohol to a minor, that eventually, even though it may go through five or six different hands, ends up in the hands of someone who uses it and it becomes a substantial factor in causing an injury to another, there is an exception to immunity.
I believe there could be because of you don't know as the provider what the underage person you're giving it to, if they have the wherewithal or the conscience to make sure it gets into the correct hands. I mean, it all stems from the illegal provision, and I think everybody, you know, down the road, you're still a third party to that original transaction.
Okay, thank you.
Can you tell me what supports this assertion that the record reflects that Marianne intended to purchase the alcohol only for Greg?
I believe that is based upon the note which says, Greg, you owe me $12, and the facts limited, albeit as we know them, that Craig was in no way, shape, or form even aware of that transaction occurring. So it would be those two things.
I mean, I just have some problems of whether or not summary judgment was ripe here, and I just throw out some hypotheticals. You know, if you have a kid and you have a cottage and the kid's going up to the cottage with friends and the kid wants alcohol, 1.75 liters, I think that a jury could find that Marianne intended to provide alcohol to the friends. And if your kid is the kind of kid that has, you know, two really good friends, and Dave and Bill and your son are always doing things together, and they go up to your cottage, and then they go over to Bill's parents' cottage sometimes, too. If the question is, did Mary Ann, or did some, you know, my hypothetical, did the mother intend to provide alcohol for those three kids, even though she was only charging her son, because she wasn't going to be able to get the money out of her. She would be lucky if she can get the money out of her son, let alone the other kids. I think there's an argument to be made that she intended, in my hypothetical, where there's three buddies, they go off, you know, to the parents' cottage for a weekend, she's getting them alcohol. I mean, is she wearing blinders? Does she think that her son isn't going to share that alcohol with the other 19-year-olds? I mean, and I suppose, but maybe, you know, I guess I'm just thinking that there are facts maybe that could be adduced that could lead to a reasonable conclusion that she intended to provide alcohol, in my hypothetical, to all three boys, and not just the son who paid her.
The problem that we had, and which I did bring up at the circuit court level, was similar to that, in that I didn't believe the defendant should be granted summary judgment in light of the extremely limited facts, given their refusal to be deposed. And arguably, could there be some facts that come up in this case that no one's even thought of that might alter an outcome? I believe that's probably conceivable. On the other hand, because of the refusal to be deposed, the pleadings as drafted, the note that says, Greg, you owe me $12, the circuit court, the appellate court, proceeded on the assumption that she only provided to Greg and that Craig in no way, shape, or form was involved. And, you know, that's the record that has been developed thus far. I guess I don't necessarily disagree that there's no fact, if there was wide open discovery, that couldn't conceivably, you know, make a difference here, but you know, that's not the record.
Well, the holding here, paragraph 12 of the Court of Appeals, is because Marianne provided alcohol to Gregory only, Craig was a third party to that transaction, and the alcohol was a substantial factor in Craig's death. Marianne is not immune under 125.0352. So my question, which is very similar to Justice Bradley's, is, as I read this, I just assumed that the factual issue was now closed. And I suppose that this would go back to a trial court, maybe not, but go back to find out if there's a substantial factor. Maybe that's no longer in the case because everybody agrees. But maybe it would go back under contributory negligence if there's that kind of defense. So do you view this case as an end? If our court, suppose our court just said, really good opinion, we adopt it. We adopt the decision written by Judge Hoover. What happens to this case?
I believe then it does get remanded for a trial where the primary issue would most likely be contributory negligence. I think the record before the trial court, as well as the Court of Appeals, as well as this court, is that she only provided to Greg. There were no affidavits suggesting otherwise.
Well,
there's no evidence.
Wouldn't you object if some evidence was proffered that would say she provided to both young men, maybe five others too?
Would I object to that?
Mm-hmm.
At this stage, I would.
Well, at the next stage, at trial.
Yes, because at the time, I think the time Marianne should have brought that up, if that was at all a fact, is at the trial court level to say, wait a minute, Your Honor, he's not a third party because here's proof Marianne gave it to him as well. They did none of that. There is no evidence ever presented about Craig being involved with Marianne.
Footnote 8 says the Andersons originally pled that Marianne gave the alcohol to Gregory or Craig, but later conceded that nothing supported the argument she supplied directly to Craig.
Yes, the pleading originally indicated that Greg supplied to Craig. As far as Marianne's concerned, it was pled in the alternative, saying she provided to Greg and or Craig. However, during oral arguments at the trial court level, it was conceded that there was no evidence that she supplied to Craig.
There's an affirmative defense in the statute, isn't there, that provides an affirmative defense to the immunity exception? And maybe I'm using affirmative defense too broadly here, but the statute does specify circumstances under which subsection 2 re-enters the picture. In other words, immunity re-enters the picture even though the exception would otherwise apply, and that is circumstances where the provider was essentially misled by the underage person by a phony ID or a false representation about legal drinking age, etc. And the reason I'm raising that is because that seems to support your argument that the transaction that is the focus of the immunity exception here is the face-to-face transaction between the provider and the underage drinker, and that anybody who is not a party to that face-to-face transaction is a third party.
Right, under sub B, sub 2, 1 and 2 is where it gets into those issues about, you know, the false ID type of thing, tricking the provider into believing you're an adult, and there are those exceptions which come under here. I think I do reference that in my brief to the point of getting into who was a provider or procurer, whether or not Craig could be, and I reference those very subsections by showing, you know, the focus is on the original transaction, because you can't trick yourself with your own fake ID. You can't lie to yourself about your age. And I think that does support that the focus is on the original provision.
So once a prima facie case that the exception applies is made, then the provider can come forward with some proof that he or she was misled by a false ID or some other false representation of the underage person in order to get immunity to re-enter the picture. And if that's the case, then that supports the construction of the statute by the Court of Appeals.
I believe that's true. Someone who lost immunity could try and get it back by saying that kid lied to me. He gave me a fake ID.
Right. And that supports the construction or the notion that what we're focusing on is that face-to-face procurement transaction, and that anybody who isn't a party to that would be a third party for purposes of piercing immunity.
That is our position, yes.
Well, but suppose you have a 22-year-old who buys the liquor, buys the alcohol beverage, but the person from whom it's bought would have every reason to believe or know that you're going to have minors drinking because there's a carload of kids who look 17. would the provider be immune under your view or liable for one of these young people getting seriously injured as a result of drinking?
I'm not sure. I understand your hypothetical completely, but if a 22-year-old bought alcohol specifically for a group of people he knew were underage,
all
or
drink together, right.
that person would have immunity if he's buying specifically for those people and he knows those people are underage.
What about
because then there's no third party that was distant, you know, a mile away from that transaction. They're all right there face to face.
Not to the provider. They're not. The provider is in the liquor store. Just sees a carload of kids. Doesn't know that the 22-year-old is going to give the liquor to the minors, but might have a good hunch.
And you're talking the provider is the vendor, the store owner.
Yes, that's what you're talking about. You want the vendor to be liable here.
But only if he's providing to an underage person, and your hypothetical is giving to a 22-year-old.
That cleans up the deal then, from your perspective.
Correct.
Does the record provide any information on what Mrs. Brazier knew about who was going to the vacation property? First of all, where do these people live?
They live near Niagara.
Niagara. Where is the vacation property?
I believe it was a relatively short distance from the Braziers' home. I'm thinking, you know, within a half an hour or so.
Okay. Is there any information that Mrs. Brazier knew who was going to the vacation property?
No. There's nothing on the record showing that she even knew her own son was going there.
But if she did, I mean, because this case, of course, sets law not only for these facts, but for broader facts. If she did know that her son was buying liquor, getting the liquor from her for his friends, Bill and Jim, what difference, if any, does that make in your argument?
I don't think it does, provided Bill and Jim were not part of that transaction. If Mary Ann maybe guessed or read between the lines that some of Greg's friends might be consuming, I don't think that changes the fact that Bill and Jim are still third parties. They had nothing to do with the transaction, even though down the road they might have hooked up with their friend and consumed the alcohol.
If she knew that she was specifically providing alcohol for Bill and Jim, the friends of her son, even though they were not there when she was asked by her son or when she delivered it to her son, she is not a provider to Bill and Jim. That's the way you're interpreting it. That Bill and Jim, even though she knows that she's getting it for them, under the statute, she's not providing it to them, under your interpretation, unless they are physically present in the request and or delivery. Is that correct?
Well, if she actually knew for a fact, I'm buying this alcohol for Bill and Jim, and Bill and Jim know they're getting it from her, then I think Bill and Jim are the underage persons to whom she's providing. And the reason is, again, all three of them have the exact same knowledge. You're the provider, you're the recipient.
So under your definition, they all have to know. She has to know she's getting it for Bill and Jim. Bill and Jim have to know that that it's being requested on their behalf. I mean, you need that. No, in the ordinary situation with a bunch of kids, the son isn't going to say, I'm getting this for Bill and Jim. I mean, she's going to know it because they're all going up to the party. So, but you're saying they have to know that it's been specifically requested on their behalf. Is that what you are requiring here?
I think in order for Mary Ann, in this case, to be a provider to whomever the underage person is, that there has to be some knowledge, some link that who the provision is for.
She can know it, but you're saying they have to know it also.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I don't look at the statute as only from one side's perspective or the other side's perspective. I look at it as a totality of the circumstances, in which case you look at, you know, who knows. In the hypothetical, if they all know, then clearly I think she's a provider and they're the underage persons. If only one side knows, I guess under that scenario it's a little bit less clear under the statute. But again, I think if Bill and Jim have no idea it's coming from her, they could still be third parties, because as far as they're concerned, they're not a party to the transaction with Mary Ann. They, you know, maybe she guessed Bill and Jim would be drinking it, but they don't know.
Why is what they know even relevant? I mean, what if they say, go and ask your mom, so we know she's getting it for us, but she has no clue? I mean, isn't it all focused on what the provider knows and what the provider does here?
Well, I think certainly that's a crucial part of the analysis. Who does the provider think it's going to? Just her son or to others? But I also think that it's a combination of the facts that determine if someone is a third party. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Pinot, you've got 5 minutes in rebuttal.
May it please the Court, please let me make 5 points. First, we take the allegations and the complaint as true. We'll live by them, as we did in the trial court in making the motion and in arguing before you here today. Secondly, the business about having two categories of parties, underage drinkers and providers, is your own categorization. In Meyer versus Champs, this court came right out and said there are two categories of parties who are not third parties, providers and underage drinkers. In Meyer, you encountered the situation where a provider was injured because he got another person intoxicated, and your conclusion was that as a first party, his claim was barred. We are asking for a perfectly reflexive response from this court here today. That is, because this young man was a second party, because he voluntarily consumed alcohol when he knew or should have known it was against the law, he rendered himself a second party by the act of consuming it. Whether he premeditated the purchase of the alcohol and plotted it all along, on the one hand, or whether he simply arrived at the vacation property and was pleasantly surprised, as teenagers often are, when vicariously stumbling across alcohol to consume, once he raised that glass to his lips, he rendered himself a second party, an underage drinker, as this very court defined that term in Meyer versus Champs.
That's only if the transaction that is the focus of the statute is the drinking as opposed to the provision.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. But I would submit that the Miller case requires that conclusion. In Miller, remember, this young woman was not a provider. She didn't provide any alcohol, but she was drinking. The point is that her drinking was not causal. Her drinking didn't result in the accident. If young Thomack, the driver of the car in Miller, had been the plaintiff in that case, trying to sue the providers, I would submit that the answer would be no. He was a second party. He was a voluntary consumer of alcohol who caused his own injuries and damages. So I think, Your Honor, that with all respect to the Meyer decision, we need to conclude in this case that there are two categories of people who cannot sue one another if one of them is injured as a result of drinking the liquor. Providers can't sue drinkers. Drinkers can't sue providers. It's perfectly reflexive because they are the first parties and the second parties, respectively, as this Court has outlined that concept in the Meyer case.
Is there anything, then, that is deterring people like Mrs. Brazier from providing alcohol to minors? I mean, it seems to me you have some good arguments on the margins and technical arguments, but the overall thrust of this is that there is no consequence to a parent just turning over, 42 ounces of liquor.
Prison. We have criminal penalties for this kind of behavior that far outshadow whether your insurance company or even your personal assets are at risk. There are significant criminal penalties involving forfeiture, involving imprisonment. If we could rewrite the statute, perhaps we'd want to take into account different considerations. But the legislature has already written it, And I think that in deference to their finding of legislative intent, I think this Court is bound by that policy determination. Would it be wiser to allow those of us in civil litigation to enforce the moral truth of what we know here today, that underage drinking is wrong and should be eliminated, even if we have to sue every last irresponsible parent on the face of the earth? Perhaps. Perhaps. But that's not the posture we find ourselves in. We find ourselves with a legislature who has preempted the common law, who has enacted a statute that provides for only specific and narrow exemptions from alcohol immunity, and provides them only in truly compelling circumstances, where it's not the person's fault. A third party is a truly innocent party to this whole cabal, the innocent driver on the road, the person who had nothing to do with the beer party. The immunity is not, the exception is not accorded for the benefit either of people who get kids drunk and are injured because they got the kid drunk, or else those children who tragically choose themselves to drink and then injure themselves as a consequence of their intoxication. The last thing I was going to say.
He had 5 points. What are they,
quickly? Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. The second point is Meyer. The third one is that we're on a slippery slope here. How far away do we have to be from the liquor store? How many iterations do we have to be removed? The truth, the practical truth, as Justice Bradley has hit upon, is that these transactions involving alcohol for minors or for underage drinkers are surreptitious. Everything happens under the table. Money is passed hand to hand to hand. Liquor is obtained through circuitous routes. And to try to reverse engineer the route that the liquor took in order to figure out whether somebody is a second party or a third party is fraught with complications. That's why I suggested respectfully that Wausau, and perhaps this Court as well, would see just about every one of these cases, because if we're going to leave open the determination as to how far enough is far enough, we provide absolutely no guidance to the litigants down the road. Fourth point is one that I already touched on when I was answering the question. A young person buys in as a second party when he raises the glass to his lips. That act and that act alone, drinking when you know you shouldn't, means that you become a second party under the Meyer versus Champs case, if and only if your drinking causes your injury. And my fifth point was that Justice Rogensack asked an excellent question, in my humble opinion, when she asked, what happens if this poor deceased boy were 21?
I'm sorry, if what?
If this poor deceased boy were 21 at the time. Alcohol travels from an adult to a minor and then back to an adult. I think that underscores the untenable posture that the respondents are taking in this case. They maintain that he's still a third party and is still entitled to sue the provider, to sue Mary Ann, even though it was legal for him to consume the alcohol. That's true because they ignore the fact that he's not a third party. He never was, whether he was 17 or whether he was had the misfortune of being as old as I am. His age doesn't matter. The fact that he was underage at the time he consumed the alcohol makes him a second party. If he to hold otherwise eviscerates the law, as pointed out in Justice Rogensack's example. I see that my light is on. Thank you very much for the experience of my legal lifetime.
Thank you, Mr. Pinot. Thank you, Mr. Kolakowski, for your arguments today on an issue that has come to the court very frequently and to the legislature also. That concludes our hearing in 020980, Mark Anderson.